Testing.
Okay, fine. Say your name. Go ahead.
My name is George Peterson. I live at 35 Cherry Crescent in Windsor Park, right now in St. Boniface.
Where were you born, George?
I was born in Winnipeg, February the 8th, 1921, at 614 Bannerman Avenue. My mother was a First World War bride, who my father met in England.
Your father, was he Canadian born?
Yes, my father's from around Belleville, Ontario.
Oh, yeah.
And when the First World War was over, my father had a sister living here, and he came to Winnipeg with my mother. Earlier recollections of my life was I was brought up in St. Patel, attended schools there, and when I was a boy I joined the usual things, trail rangers, sea cadets, and Cameron Highlander cadets. In 1937 or 36, I believe it was, I joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers bugle band. At that time I had to have a note from my father saying that I could join, and I belonged to the Grenadiers when war broke out.
What type of work were you doing, George?
I was, I had been out of school for a year and shining shoes for a year, but I was going to go back to school. And of course, when war broke out, my plans were a little bit changed.
What was your education?
I went as far as grade 9 in high school, junior high. When war did break out, I was in Carmen, Manitoba, harvesting, and of course things started, I felt that I should come back into Winnipeg, and I actually went on active service on September the 2nd. I was paid from September the 2nd. I didn't actually sign on for active service, though. It was September the 6th, but I was paid by militia up to that time. I joined up on September the 6th, my brother on September the 9th, my father on September the 12th.
Was your brother older or younger than you?
My brother and I are twins.
Right.
That's right. Everything was, we joined up at Minto Armories. We were still living at home, drawing subsistence allowance. And everything was sort of hectic.
How'd your mom feel about you joining up? You know, your father, you, and your brother.
Well, I don't know. She didn't say too much about it. Of course, she was, what she has always said, British to the core. Mm-hmm. I've always told her that she was smart enough to come to Canada, though, to be educated. But she didn't seem to say too much about it. My father was very disappointed that he couldn't get into the Grenadiers with us. But, of course, he had to lower his age, and he finally made it into the Winnipeg Light Infantry. Times at Minto were, I can remember them, past fellows going around with half a uniform. The fellows that had full uniforms, of course, were most of the ones that had been in the militia. Instead of going into the bugle band when war broke out, I joined D Company and became an instructor in both rifle, Vickers machine gun, and finally a PT.
What's a PT?
A physical training.
Oh, PT, I see, have a gun. Oh, yeah. Did you have to take a course to become an instructor, or you just do it naturally?
No, we took, well, it wasn't exactly a course. It was just through training and reading books, more or less.
You weren't sent away in any...
No, 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 I stayed with the regiment.
What rank did you have?
I joined the as a private, and I finally ended up as a sergeant. In December, just after the first Canadian draft, went to England. We moved from Minto Armories to Fort Osborne Barracks, and we stayed there until the following June. Most of this was time was spent in Vickers machine gun training, mostly as along with infantry training. In June, of course, our outfit was moved out, and we ended up in Jamaica for internment camp and things like this, duties. In Jamaica, it was a pleasant life, really, although it wasn't what we had actually in mind when we did join up.
I suppose you were thinking of England, didn't you?
Yes. I would have liked to see my relatives over there, for one thing. And, this internment camp wasn't exactly my idea of what we should have been doing, especially with reading how the war was going on the different fronts and this. It wasn't more or less, I don't think it was a thought of patriotism, or, although I don't really know at the time. Of course, when we left Jamaica, we were quite happy that we were going someplace else. We had been rumors that were quite rife around the camp that we were to come back to Canada, and the NCOs were to be given officer training course, and the men were to be given NCO training course. Of course, this didn't happen. My brother and I were on the first draft that did come back from Jamaica. We were stationed in the old Robinson building in Winnipeg. A lot of the time that we were here, I was on more or less guard duty at the Robinson building with 24 hours on and 24 off, which I felt was rather pretty good for me, because it gave me a lot more time to spend with my family.
Were you
on the days
then?
That I know. Look up my old girlfriends, of course. Then we had orders that we were moving out, and we had heard that we were going west. With this, it all came back that we were actually going to go to Nanaimo for officer training. Of course, when we hit Vancouver, we had quite a shock when we were put on a boat.
Did you have any misgivings? Did you have any idea about the East, or the war in the East?
I can't say that I really had misgivings for myself. My brother was confined to barracks in Winnipeg here for something that he had done. And the day that we left Winnipeg, I had to go to the RSM and get permission to take him into my custody, more or less, and for him to say goodbye to my mother and father. This was granted, and at the time, I asked my brother, or I told my brother, that if he wanted to go over the hill, it would be quite all right. For myself, I had no idea of doing anything like this, but I thought that maybe he should get out of it.
Why, do you think?
Why, I don't know.
Do you think he sort of didn't take to rules and regulations? Was that his temperament?
Well, more or less, I believe it was. But Well, as the saying goes, he knew what every guard room looked like, wherever he had been. And we had a little trouble in Vancouver when we got on the boat. We didn't like the cramped quarters that we were on the boat. But this was more or less all worked out, and of course the ship sailed. We stopped in Hawaii on the way, and we weren't allowed off the boat though, but they did bring some girls down and danced for us on the pier. And then, of course, we arrived in Hong Kong. The morning that we arrived in Hong Kong, when the three British planes came out to meet our boat, we didn't think too much of their air force. And if we had known, I guess, what we were getting into, we would have thought an awful lot less. When we were into our barracks at Sham Shui Po in Hong Kong and settled down, then our more or less training started out. But to my way of thinking, this training wasn't what should have been going on. When we should have been in the hills, more or less, learning the terrain of the country. And instead, we were on the parade square learning how to salute again. Myself, I was sent on a PT course up to the command gymnasium. And I was there when the war broke out.
Did you go into the village at all, into the city of Hong Kong?
Oh, yes, several times.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression of the place?
Well, that it was a very smelly place, very crowded, and that life in China was very cheap.
It was a change from Jamaica.
It was a big change from Jamaica. Well, to a certain extent, the waterfront still smelled the same, of course, as it did in Jamaica. And there was squalor in Jamaica the same way as what there was in Hong Kong. I was taken away from my company, as I said, and sent on this PT course. And the morning the war broke out, we were told the night before that war was imminent. I was in town the night before on a pass, and when we got back to the barracks that night, which was quite early in the morning, really, I guess, we were told that war was imminent and that we were to get ready to move out. The next thing we knew, it was morning, and the Japanese were bombing Hong Kong.
How did you feel then? Did you did the gravity of the situation enter your mind?
No, it was something that possibly we had all the time in the back of our minds, knowing that it was coming. But no, it was. For instance, one of the fellows was before the bombs started dropping, when these planes were coming over. One of the fellows was running around saying, "Oh, who says the British haven't got airplanes?" But they turned out to be Japanese planes, of course.
That's how much your airplane recognition
you. That's right.
And were you in any way instructed how to get out of bomb range or anything?
No, just that word come through that we were to report back to our companies. And I was told where to go to Wang Lichong Gap. And I got back to my company about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and reported to my company commander. And I had just settled down with my section again. I was actually a section corporal. And when word came that I was to leave the section, and I was taken over to another place for company that they had made up, hence the fellows that I had actually trained with, most of them, that is, in D Company. I wasn't really with them when the war started or when we went into action at all. Some of the places that I was at was there. Wan Chai Gap, which was a ammunition dump, and a police station up the hill. We were there more or less guarding the place, but we didn't really see any action there except some shelling from the mainland. There was one night when they were shelling pretty heavily, and we had already heard that the Japanese were on the island. We did hear quite a noise coming around the road of a vehicle moving, rattling, banging along, and I went out with the sentry to find out who it was and what it was. And one of the fellows yelled back, is it all right to come through here? And I recognized his voice as George Harrison. And I yelled back, yes, that it was safe for them to come through. And my brother yelled out, he was on this car, and they had just come from Wan Le Chong Gap, where the Japanese had encircled the whole Canadian Brigade headquarters. That night we pulled back further, and we were more or less held in waiting for what, I don't know. But then word came for us to go back up to Reservoir.
Oh, yeah.
No, it was Mount Cameron was on the right or left, and Mount Bennett on the other side.
So you were pulled back to the reservoir?
Bennett's Ridge. No, we moved up to this place, and then this was a couple of days before Christmas, really, and our plan of action was that we had three Vickers machine guns set up and trained on this ridge where we knew the Japanese were going to attack. I guess it was the day before Christmas, because that night, or that day, we had gathered what we thought was a good amount of food for a Christmas dinner the next day. But the Japanese attacked that night, and we had to pull back, which was our strategy. And these Vickers machine guns were opened up. We pulled quite a ways back that night, and then the next day, of course, we were told that the war was over, but the island had surrendered.
Excuse me a minute.
Yes, we did, actually. But there was always the story that Chiang Kai-shek on his big white horse was always coming to relieve us.
No, but I mean in the battle itself. Did you realize how outnumbered you were?
I believe we did, yes. Especially when they were able to get a good foothold on the island on the night of the 18th. And seemed fairly hopeless at that time, that we just weren't going to be able to go back far enough. And before we run out of land to go back to. On Christmas Day, the people I was with were told, of course, to lay down our arms. The first thing I did was to smash my weapons and throw them away. We did think of hiding some of them, but then we didn't know where we would end up. As a matter of fact, I ended up back at the command gymnasium again, and I was able to get some of the one of my kit bags that I had left there from the command gymnasium. A couple of days later, we were marched down to the university grounds, and this was used as a gathering point. And then from there, we were taken to Wan Chai Barracks, which was a former refugee camp, and we stayed there for quite some time, of course. And then from there, we were taken back to Sham Shui Po Barracks. And then the rough part of the life, I guess, started.
And when you were in this refugee camp, there was all type of people there?
No,
just the military.
Just the military.
And the Japs were not organized to take care of you, were they?
Not really, no. Apparently, we were the first troops that they had ever actually taken prisoner of war. And to them, of course, the person that was became a prisoner of war had lost face entirely to the Japanese people, and they were nothing. The food, of course, was just, at first of all, was just rice and very little else. Once in a while, if we had something to trade, we could go to the fence and trade with some of the Chinese people if they weren't shot or beaten or anything like this. The first year in camp was the really rough one, up until about November, when we finally did get a Red Cross parcel, which did boost the morale of the camp up.
You were not hurt?
An awful lot.
You were not injured or hurt?
No. No, I wasn't wounded at all.
How about diphtheria? Did that hit you?
No. No, I'd had diphtheria as a child, so I guess I was immune to it. The beriberi in camp was quite great, of course, and the diphtheria. Malnutrition as a whole set in, and up to November the first year, morale was beginning to get quite low when the Red Cross parcels came through.
What did you do first year? Were you in work detailing?
Yes, we worked out at the airport and moving this big hill by hand, picking shovel, and life was just one day following the next, always looking for something more to eat, and trying to live as best as you could. One day seemed to follow the next, and just about the same pattern all the time.
Did you do any hobbies
or anything in camp? Well, I did start a cookbook at one time, different recipes, but I decided after a while that this was just more or less teasing yourself, and just dreaming of what you were going to eat when you got out. And I didn't think very much those days, except of getting more to eat, really, and of when we would get out.
Were you punished at all? Did you get into any bad breaks?
No, I didn't personally. Of course, my brother did a couple of times. I used to say more or less in line, I guess, and did what I was told.
That's why you worried about your brother coming alive.
No, we were together. Well, we were separated twice. I went to hospital, to Bone Road Hospital with dysentery, for 7 weeks at a time. And then once we got back to Shanta, it was at North Point Camp, actually, that where I had the dysentery. And I went from there to Bone Road Hospital, and then back to North Point, and then, of course, we went to Shamshapo Barracks after that. Everything stayed about the same. Oh, there was rumors, of course, going around all the time that the war would soon be over. We used to more or less project a date that was never any more than 6 months ahead of any one period of time when we would, when the war would be over and we would get out.
Did you think of escape?
One thing I did forget to mention, I guess, yes, Sergeant John Payne was a very good friend of mine, and he was the intelligence sergeant in the Winnipeg Grenadiers. And when we were first taken prisoner of war, we made a calendar and put 100 days on it. And our plan was that if we were still prisoners by the time the 100 days were up, that we would try to escape. In the meantime, he would try to get in contact with some of the Japanese on the outside or something or other, but try to make plans for this. However, before the 100 days were up, this is when I took sick with dysentery and malaria the first time, and when the plan finally came to a head, I wasn't able to go. The night that John left, of course, as far as we could determine after, the Chinese that he had been in contact with turned him in, and they were taken up into the hills and executed, three of them.
What was his plan? Did you have any idea?
I had no idea. I didn't want to know about it. Unless I could go along with them. And I knew I wasn't strong enough at that time to go along with them. So I stayed out of it.
How did you feel in those Red Cross classes?
Well, at that time, of course, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to us. It boosted the morale of the camp very much, and I honestly believe that it did save an awful lot of lives.
How many did you get?
Well, just the one at that time. And we found out after, of course, that it was half robbed, but this didn't make any difference to us. We were still, it was still more or less Canadian food, but we tried to make it last as long as possible, of course. The life in Shamshapo was just about the same day after day until, of course, they started taking people out and taking them on a draft to Japan. We missed the first one, and we were on the last one, actually, to go to Japan. It was the only medical that we had when they decided that there was going to be a draft, was that they lined you up in a circle around the doctor, and he asked you several questions. Then he decided that you were strong enough to go to work in Japan. The boat trip was actually, we were quite happy about it, going to Japan at the time. Possibly just for the change of scenery or something new.
How many were you in that last trip?
As far as I know, about 250 Canadians. And I just forget, well, it was roughly 15 or 16 months before the war was over, I believe. I forget the actual dates. We did have a little bit of a scare on the way over of being put down in the hatch and battened down on us, but we were told after it was just a submarine drill or something, I don't know.
Were you in the hold all the way, or were you on top?
No, we were allowed up on deck at times.
What type of a ship were you on?
I'm not too familiar with ships, but it was not too large a ship. I would say it would be some kind of a small freighter.
Oh, I see.
And then, of course, when we landed on Japan, the first thing they did was line us all up. And these people come out with masks and some kind of a spray gun that they sprayed us all down. And we were put on trains and taken through Tokyo. And we ended up at Sendai number 2, which is about 120 miles north of Sendai. We didn't know it at the time, but there was another camp about 14 miles across country from us. In Japan, of course, we worked in a coal mine, which wasn't very nice. We were told that if there was ever an invasion of Japan or bad accident down the mine, that the mine would just be sealed off and they wouldn't even attempt to take us out.
Nice pleasant thought, eh?
It wasn't very good under working conditions. Then
what did you do in the coal mine?
I was being an NCO, I was put in charge of a gang directly under a Japanese mine boss. The miners themselves were, most of them were not too bad. They more or less treated us with a certain respect as long as we did our work and got our quota out. There were days when we decided that we'd pass the word around that we would try to have them cut our quota down. When we passed the word around not to put out our the tons that they wanted. And these actually days were harder than what it would have been if we had gone ahead and put out what they wanted. I was, as I say, in charge
in
of...
In what way would you qualify that statement?
Well, for instance, we'd throw a truck off the track, or we'd blast wrong, or do something that just to slow down production, anything at all that we could think of, really, as long as we could get caught at it.
What was your reasoning behind this?
Well, for one thing, we were, ours was a shift of all Canadians, and the other shift was made up mainly of Portuguese. These people apparently had gone to the Japanese and said to them that they were all office workers and the Canadians were not office workers. They were used to driving trucks or laborers, more or less, and that we should have to put out more coal than they did, and the Japanese agreed with them. Hence, their quota was much lower than ours, which we didn't think was quite right. And this is why we would have our days that we'd decide we'd try to have them cut the quota down, which normally didn't work. But here again, we felt that possibly we were holding back the Japanese war effort a little bit, too. Possibly the best of our ability to hold it back, which really wasn't too much.
Were these Portuguese people, were they POWs?
They were POWs that had from the Portuguese colony in Hong Kong. They were part of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps. In the mine, we got to know several of the bosses. That one I remember in particular was a man we called Ishigawa-san, and he was quite reasonable with us. Another fellow was a man that we called a screamer. Just as his name implies, if we didn't do something right, he'd scream at us. But he wasn't really bad either. The people in the camp, as long as we did what they wanted us to do, it wasn't really bad. But of course, if you were sick or something, you went on half rations, which we had already agreed. The whole camp had agreed that no one would be on half rations, but it meant that whoever was sick, there was that much less rice brought into camp for the body as a whole. Could you turn it off for just a moment?
Okay.
And our weeks were anywhere from 10 to 14 days long when we had what they called a Yasame day, which was a free day. And these days we didn't care too much about it. They were actually search days. What the Japanese were searching for, I don't know. They never did find anything, really. But,
how do you make out for clothing and things, shoes and stuff like that?
Well, in Japan, of course, in Hong Kong also, we had all had wooden clogs that we would make, and sometimes it was just the sole of an old shoe with a strap on top of it. We all had our army boots, of course, when we were first taken prisoners of war, which lasted a couple of years or so. And then in Japan, they issued us with these two-toed running shoes, where your big toe was in one side and the rest of your toes were in the other, buttoned up the back. These actually were our mine shoes also. For safety equipment in the mine, all we had was a hat with a piece of felt in it, and we had a jacket, a pair of pants, and these running shoes. Most of the time in the mine, though, all we wore was our hat and a loincloth and shoes because of the heat there. The days in the mine were all more or less the same.
Did you ever play baseball or do anything at all?
No, the camp in Japan wasn't big enough for one thing. In Hong Kong, we played baseball once in a while, and we did put on a couple of shows where my brother and I took the part of chorus girls and things. But,
did you get a bang out of it, or was it just
something? Well, it was something to do, and
Bardell put those on, did it?
Well, actually, it was Harry McNaughton that was behind it more than anybody. He was one of the original dumbbells. Or dumbbells.
Dumbbells.
I believe it was, yeah. And it was interesting at the time.
Did the Japanese let you have baseball equipment, or how did you get that? Did they issue it to you and then take it away after a game, or what?
I couldn't rightly say. I don't remember. But I don't remember playing too often either. Here again and baseball or anything like this, I was more or less more of a spectator than a player.
You had a pretty good team in Jamaica though, didn't you?
Yes, we did. But, in Jamaica though, the sports that I went in for was, boxing and tennis and badminton. And I did buy a bicycle for a while, and I used to go out riding around the country with them. Getting back to Japan, though, in the mine, the days were more or less the same there, too. When it was starting to get towards the, we didn't know it at the time, but towards the end of the war, we could hear the battleships shelling the coastline. We were about 5 miles, we found out after, from the coastline. And, possibly 2 or 3 weeks, I imagine it would be now, before the war ended, and we could hear some talk of escape again. Here again, though, we did know a smattering of Japanese language. And if there was a way that we could have possibly made our way to the coast without being detected or something, some of us may have tried it, but it never actually got down quite to that far in the planning. We apparently were in the one of the ways of the airline of the American bombing of Tokyo, and of course once in a while the planes would come over and we'd hear an air raid siren go. Everything was blacked out, of course, and we didn't really know how the war was going. We had heard about the atomic bombs being dropped by the Japanese interpreter, who here again was a man that had been brought up in the States and had lived in the States for about 42 years, as far as I can remember, and he had retired and come back to Japan to live. His wife was American-born, and he wouldn't tell us too much, but every once in a while he would drop a little information. Of course, when he told us that Nagasaki and Hiroshima had been bombed and 150,000 and 250,000 killed in two places with two bombs, we couldn't quite grasp the hugeness or greatness of this one bomb. We heard of a small amount of the devastation that had taken place, but we just couldn't believe it. The day that the war was over, we were in the mine, and we knew something was up because we were told that we were going up before it was actually quitting time, before our quota was finished. And these Japanese people were saying that to us, sansu awari, which in Japanese means that the war is over. Here again, we didn't believe them. Thought possibly that this was another trick. However, when we did get up back into camp, rumors were quite right that the war was over, but we didn't actually hear officially that it was over until the next day when the Japanese commandant lined us all up, and this was the first time that he didn't speak to us in Japanese and have an interpreter tell us what he was speaking about. This time he spoke in fairly good English. And
did you have any idea that he knew English?
We had a suspicion that a lot of them could speak English, but we couldn't really prove it. For instance, in the mine, there was one man that we called Fishface. Why, I don't really recall, but he was kind of more or less cold to us. And there were several occasions when people would go up to him and call him names and in English, talk to him, and he still wore this blank expression that he didn't understand. But the day that a few days after the war was over, I don't know just how we came in contact with him again, but one of the fellows did go up to him and speak to him and say to him, "You can understand English, can't you?" And he said, "Yes, I can," just as plain as what I can say. But the camp commandant told me, we didn't really know if he could or not, but he And apparently a lot of them could, but didn't let on that they knew any English at all. The day after, we were told that at the same time when the camp commandant, his first words to us were, "My boys, the day for which we have all long looked for has at last arrived. The war has been officially declared over." And I don't remember too much more of it, except that he told us that the war was over, but that we would have to go back down the mine and still work until we were officially taken out and taken back to Tokyo or wherever they thought that they would take us to be freed. And we objected strongly to it, of course. And he finally decided that we wouldn't have to go down the mine that day, that he would declare a yesterday day. And as it came about, the next day word came through that all work was to cease and that we would soon be run into Tokyo for our journey home. The day that the planes came over, first of all, of which I have a letter there, this was the day that we actually discovered that there was another camp fairly close to us, because we could see the planes circling this camp and dropping old parachutes and things from the sky to them. And for a long time, these planes were making larger circles, apparently trying to find us. It took them some time, but they finally did. And this is when I believe the pilots themselves of the planes must have been just as excited as what we were, because one of them even threw his own personal suitcase out with what was in it, I don't know now. Then, of course, the next day there were more planes came over and they started throwing, dropping supplies to us. One incident that I recall quite vividly was getting back to this Japanese saving of face. One of the B-29s came over and they had two 45-gallon drums welded together, and as it turned out, it was full of sugar, chocolate, and milk, tin milk. And there was a parachute tied to these two drums, but the weight of the drums broke the parachute away, and the drums hit a small Japanese boy that was playing in one of the paddy fields, and killed him instantly, of course. And his playmates just laughed about it. This was what they call saving face. We felt quite bad about it, but of course there was nothing that we could do. Our orders were to stay in camp and wait for the Americans to come in and tell us what to do, where we were to be taken. But this one day when we were allowed out of the camp to pick up these supplies that the planes were dropping, my brother and a Portuguese fellow and myself decided that we would walk over to the next camp and see who was there. So we started off, and we did eventually get to the camp, and found quite a few of our friends there, of course. That night, there was two Japanese guards sent from our camp over to this new camp to pick us up and return us to our original camp. And when we got back, we were taken before the camp commandant, and he gave us quite a dressing down for leaving the camp. We were told that we were not gentlemen, that we had been on our word, that we wouldn't try to go anywhere, which I didn't recall giving my word that I wouldn't try to leave. But finally word came through then that we were to get on the train at the next morning, and we were taken into Tokyo. When we arrived in Tokyo, we were taken to a receiving station, and this was the only we were fed. This was the only meal that there was ever any more or less rationing put on us, that we weren't allowed to go back for seconds or thirds or whatever we wanted. We weren't allowed to eat as much as we wanted for fear that we would all get sick with eating this food again. The next day we went on board a hospital ship, and then we received quite a few medical examinations, of course, and with each doctor we went before, apparently they were quite believers in vitamin pills, because by the time I arrived home, which was approximately 3 weeks from the time we were released from our camp to the time I got back to Winnipeg, I believe it was 16 vitamin pills a day that I was taking.
Were you self-conscious about your parents? Were you all of a sudden aware that you...
Not really. For myself, I weighed about 120 pounds when I was released, and within 6 weeks, I weighed 178 pounds. This was one of the things that possibly worked against us when we arrived home, in that we looked very good, I thought, at the time. And, of course, I believe a lot of this had to do with beriberi. I know I had beriberi quite a lot of it, even after I got home, and it took some time for it to clear up. But, on a whole, I thought we looked very well. From the hospital ship in Tokyo Bay, we were taken on board the USS Iowa, and originally, I believe the plan was for us to, the Iowa was to return to San Francisco for the 30th of October, which was Navy Day, and I believe the original plan was for us to go back on her. We stayed on board the Iowa for approximately 5 days, and one of the first things I recall on boarding the ship was that the executive officer was one of the first people that told us that we had done our share, and now it was their turn to make it up to us, which they did. We were treated very well. Instead of being put in just one place on the ship, we were more or less distributed in with the crew. And they couldn't seem to do too much for us. If we were hungry, we were told to go down to the galley, if the door was locked, to knock on the door, and not ask them for anything, but tell them that we wanted such and such, and we would receive it. From the Iowa, we were taken to the airport, and flew from Yokohama Airport, I believe it was, to, we were stopped overnight on Iwo Jima because of bad storms over Guam. And some of us were able to make a small tour of the island, and it was amazing to me anyway, the way Iwo Jima had been fortified. It was just full of caves where you could go in one cave and come out practically any place you wanted on the island. The next day, of course, we took off for Guam again. We stayed in Guam for 3 or 4 days, had a couple more medicals, more vitamin pills. And the Americans also threw a party for us that we were able to have a few beers for the first time in a few years. From Guam, we took off again and to landed on the Gilbert Islands, from there to the Johnson Island, and then from there to Honolulu. We stayed in Honolulu for approximately 36 hours with more medical and more vitamin pills. From there, we flew in a PB2Y4 to San Francisco, where we landed in San Francisco and then were taken to a naval hospital in Oakland. In Oakland, the Red Cross had it set up that we were able to phone home for the first time and talk to our families. And then from there we were put on a train and we arrived back in Vancouver. And just before we got to Vancouver, our train stopped in New Westminster, BC, and we were able to. My brother and myself were interviewed on a radio broadcast for a couple of minutes just while the train was stopped at the station. And from there, we didn't realize it at the time, but apparently this was being broadcast live. And by the time we reached Vancouver, there were quite a number of our friends who were living in Vancouver at the time on the train to meet us. When we arrived in Vancouver, we were taken to one of the hospitals, and here we were issued with two new uniforms, Canadian uniforms, and our own army clothing. And we stayed in Vancouver for two or three days, and then got on the train for Winnipeg. One thing I didn't mention about when we arrived on the USS Arway, we didn't have too much clothing left, and we ended up coming back to Canada actually in U.S. naval clothing, which shoes, underwear, to actual dungarees. Complete with hat and all. When we got on the train in Vancouver, previous to this, my brother and I had been slated to leave the day before, but we were kind of having a good time, so we intentionally missed our train for 24 hours. Of course, when we arrived back in Winnipeg, our family knew that we were on our way home, and that we were to arrive that night. We arrived at the CP station. They had the ladies' waiting room blocked off with all our relatives and friends there, which was quite a reception. And then, of course, we got in the cars and went home to St. Vital. I guess that's it.
Yeah. Were there Americans in your camp?
Just two, as far as I know.
Do you feel that when you were in the Marlborough, one of those different camps, that the Japs treated any prisoners differently, or do you think you're all treated the same?
Well, as I said before, in regards to work, they treated the Canadians, I believe, a little more harshly than what they did the Portuguese, because they figured the Portuguese were all office workers and that we should work harder than they did.
But there was no other difference?
No, not. I do think that in cases that I had heard about, that they did treat the Americans possibly a little worse than anyone else. With us, more or less, they thought possibly that we had made a mistake, this is all.